Welcome to The Reader, your guide to Australian development in the region. This is a fortnightly podcast by the Development Intelligence Lab, hosted by our CEO, Bridie Rice.
Welcome back, Joe and James, for another action-packed episode of The Readout. There's been plenty happening over the last fortnight, and today we're going to cover recent developments. We've got Australia sending extra aid to Sudan, the release of Japan's new development policy. We're then going to turn our minds to Australia's development approach in Southeast Asia. And once again, we're going to take a look at Australia's development policy. I know we've been saying it every week. It has not yet been announced, but we're today going to have a look at locally led development and what lessons Australia can draw from the USAID experience. So let's begin. Well, lots has been happening over the last fortnight. On 20th of June, the Foreign Minister announced that the Australian government will provide a further $4.45 million to respond to the escalating humanitarian crisis in Sudan. So that's bringing Australia's contribution to Sudan and support in neighbouring countries up to around $10.45 million. Now, the minister said these funds will provide immediate relief to the most vulnerable people facing violence and food insecurity in Sudan, and they'll be delivered largely through the International Committee of the Red Cross. We're talking food, water, emergency medical supplies. James, you headed up Australia's humanitarian assistance for many years. What's your take on the situation here?
Well, the first thing I'd say, Bridie, is that as it was during my time, it's sadly not enough. I think there's probably about the equivalent of the population of Australia in need, in humanitarian need. And that amount obviously is just a drop in the ocean. Now, of course, it's not just down to Australia. I think the overall ask is over $2 billion. And once again, we're seeing the West, I guess, neglecting sub-Saharan Africa. And interestingly, almost delivering on their commitments to Ukraine. So I think we still have to deal with that bias in the humanitarian allocation system. But the other thing I'd note is that, frankly, you know, even having a lot more money available is not the answer in the humanitarian space. And you know, preempting and preventing these sorts of challenges is what humanitarian dollars should be invested in. And again, it's a challenge that Australia and other donors face to embrace the ambitions of the grand bargain. And there was actually a report out in the last couple of weeks, I think, by ODI on the grand bargain, which suggested that while there's some progress, some of the great constraints are still not really been addressed.
Absolutely. And of course, coming into the end of this year with the SDG summit as well, I think we're going to see a real heating up of development finance and humanitarian finance conversations in the coming months. In other news, we've seen Japan release its new development charter, a worthy read, and if we've got time today, we'll have a look at that. The big news that I want to cover is about the release of the Overseas Development Institute's Principled Aid Index. And I've got to say, I'm a big fan of ODI, and ODI is a UK-based think tank that does some world-class analysis and policy engagement, and I'm a big fan of what this index is trying to do. So let me have a go at explaining it briefly. Before we get to the verdict of what this Principled Aid Index is saying when it comes to Australian development spend. So what ODI is saying is that principled aid, right? So that's donors like Australia taking a principle-based approach to how we're spending our development dollar. It simply shouldn't be taken for granted when the goal of things like winning allies, defending democracy, safeguarding supply chains in increasingly what they call ensnaring approach to development cooperation is on foot. So this Principled Aid Index is measuring countries' commitment to advancing their long-term enlightened self-interest. So a high rank would indicate that a country is recognizing how its own interests in global stability, prosperity, and resilience are tied to the success, most importantly, tied to the well-being of other nations. And the index looks country by country, scoring donors across three dimensions. So the first one is development gaps, right? So it's asking, are countries allocating their aid dollar to critical development challenges? The second thing they look at is global cooperation. So are countries allocating their aid dollar to the sorts of activities that are addressing shared global challenges? And the third category, my favorite, is public-spiritedness. And what ODI is asking here is each country maximizing every opportunity it has with its aid dollar to achieve development impact, thinking about its narrower domestic gains simply as an indirect consequence? Now, I know that sounds very theoretical. We're going to make it real. Put frankly, what this index is asking is, are we using our development dollars to fund cables in the Pacific to stop China funding them? Or are we funding them to achieve internet connectivity and human development for the region? Now, Australia's ranked 21 out of 29 donors on the index. We've dropped 3 places since 2021 alone. At the top of the charts, you've got Sweden in good company with the UK, the US and others. Hot on their heels in the middle band, you've got South Korea, Japan, Switzerland, Germany and the likes. And then in the bottom band of this index is Australia in the company of Hungary, the Czech Republic, Greece and others. Joe, I want to turn to you first. What is your take on this index?
Wow. We're right there at the bottom, aren't we? I think Australia definitely does care about how it's perceived globally. It does care about how it fares on rankings like this. So you might argue about, you know, the validity of the rankings, the methodology, how it was done. But nevertheless, I think it will have an impact. And I think the main impact here is reinforcing this notion that intent matters. It does matter why we are doing what we're doing. And that people are interpreting that through their own lenses. So regardless of what we say we are doing, I think it will be fairly transparent to our partners, to the international community, what we're doing and why we're doing it. And so if we are cynically using development dollars towards things that really aren't about the development outcomes for our partners, I think rankings like this are a bit of a judgment on that, but it does reinforce the idea that that in itself is not in our national interest. It doesn't go down well. People can see through that, and we actually end up shooting ourselves in the foot.
So, Joe, of course, you're absolutely right. This is a pretty devastating result. At the same time, my bet is that policymakers here in Canberra will say, well, the only reason Australia is dropping in the ranks is because we choose to spend our development dollar in the Indo-Pacific. Okay? We're not major contributors to global cooperation, comparatively speaking. And you can see that in the rankings. Australia is ranked lower on the first two dimensions of this index around allocating aid to critical development challenges and addressing shared global challenges. James, what's your take on this? Is that fair?
Well, technically it's fair because this is not a measure of volume. It's independent of volume. The first criterion that you identified, development gaps, because it's measured according to country income and because the Pacific country income is comparatively high compared to where many other donors focus, Africa, that's the outcomes. And interestingly, while Australia is in the bottom third, the public spiritedness criterion, which is the measure or the closest of the measures to, I think, Joe, you might have called it cynicism. But anyway, actually Australia, I think, features fourth or something like that. I mean, it's interesting that it does. I didn't find this index as useful as the Center for Global Development Index, Commitment to Development Index, which I think is a bit more comprehensive. But Joe's right. They're a useful mechanism for throwing a light on the sort of overall focus and intent of the aid program. Therefore, they ask some important questions. And I'm sure Australia doesn't want to be in the company it's currently keeping.
That's right. The CGD index on the commitment to development is another great measure. Of course, these measures are only as good as the data available to them. And I think both these think tanks are really trying to push the needle on the policy motivations, as you say, Joe, behind development, not simply where the money goes and why as well. So it's certainly something to watch. Of course, we saw Japan also release its new development charter. They're calling it one of the most important tools of Japanese diplomacy. I certainly hope our ministers are saying the same thing when they launch Australia's development policy. But in a succinct 22 pages, look, it's a pretty solid read. Now, no doubt Canberra development policymakers are unpicking it. But to me, it sends a really clear signal that Japan is stepping out on development, out much louder and prouder. So what's the standout feature for you in this new policy?
Well, I guess a lot of the language is quite similar to language we've seen being used by Australia, by the US in terms of supporting the international rules-based order, supporting peace and democracy, aligned to Quad statements and so on. I thought it was interesting. There is quite a clear statement about the geopolitical context and stating that developing countries in general don't want to get involved in choosing sides or being involved in the geopolitical contest, but that some seem sympathetic to moves that challenge the free and open international order. So it's pretty forward-leaning. It's pretty frank about this contextual analysis. And the other interesting thing about it to me is that it makes some clear statements about what ODA should not be. Rather pointed, I think. It should not be about economic coercion or debt traps. It should be delivering quality infrastructure, and quality infrastructure is transparent and open and looking at life cycle and maintenance issues and building local capacity. So I think there's some very pointed remarks and comments in there that's pitting Japan as a good donor that's on the side of transparency and strong development outcomes. I think it's a really well-crafted, clear policy document. So hopefully it is something that everyone's having a look at in Canberra.
James, what's your own?
Oh, look, this is, I love your relentless optimism, Bridie. I don't see this as very much more than just another example of the geostrategic competition being played out in aid programs around the region. And I think I may have misread it, but I think this was simultaneously announced with Japan opening a smallish new concept of military aid. Maybe we shouldn't be too optimistic about where this is going.
Yeah, I think there'd be a few people in Washington rubbing their hands together, thinking that Japan has joined the pro-democracy out loud bandwagon with this policy. So seeing how this plays out in the region is going to be interesting. Of course, Japan has been one of the movers and shakers with their development finance over the years. They've learned a few tough lessons on exactly how to engage in the Indo-Pacific. I think you're right, Joe. There's some pretty clear signals that they're engaging with the geopolitics. And I guess on my mind is the question of, is it better to be clear about that in your development policy or just leave it unwritten? So I guess we'll see in the coming weeks which way Australia decides to go. Turning our minds now to Southeast Asia, and I'm really keen to unpick this topic with you, Joe and James. Look, over the last few years, many have argued that consecutive Pacific step-ups, particularly over the last decade, have really come at the cost of a Southeast Asia step down when it comes to development. In 2015, the Australian government cut its aid program by around $1 billion in 1 year, and many countries in Southeast Asia were hit hard. But since then, we have started to see a few signals that are swinging things back the other way. So we've had the establishment of the Office of Southeast Asia. Of course, this May's budget announced a small boost to development assistance for Southeast Asia, including $50 million for a government-to-government partnerships program. But many around town are a little concerned by the disproportionate focus of Australian development on the Pacific, and now even more so that perhaps our imagination when it comes to development is really dominated by our work in the Pacific Islands, overlooking some of the nuance and different challenges that development faces in Southeast Asia. So on the Intel a week or two ago, we posed the question to three analysts. Does Australia have the development skills, the stamina and the leadership when it comes to development cooperation in Southeast Asia? Joe, what's your take?
Well, I think there's no question that such significant cuts are going to reverberate and impact on our engagement for quite a while. It will take a long time and a lot of effort to rebuild from there. And I agree with Nicola's commentary that it is all about relationships. That's what we've got to focus on. And thinking about how we do try to rebuild those relationships, whether it's with government or civil society organisations, and be very clear about the kinds of impacts that sudden changes in direction, sudden massive cuts in budget have on those relationships. So I guess that needs to be the starting point. But I think in terms of Australia's development cooperation in Southeast Asia, I mean, our engagement in Indonesia, where I was just a couple of weeks ago, it's the jewel in the crown, right? The kinds of development cooperation we've got going on in Indonesia still to this day just astounds me. I think the kinds of influence, the kinds of policy development we're involved in, the contributions we're making to poverty reduction are truly amazing. So I actually think it continues to be a model for the rest of our development cooperation that we can be learning from. So I don't think by any means that, you know, we've given up the ghost and need to completely rebuild. There's so much still there that we can be continuing to build on and learn from, even in the Pacific.
I absolutely loved the contribution we had from DS on this. Of course, DS had been a very senior aid programmer for DFAT for many years in Jakarta. And she wrote that Australia would do well to position itself as a strategic learning partner for growing economies in Southeast Asia. James, is this something that Australia's development program is well equipped to take on? And what would it take for the development program to really step up and be an appropriate partner in Southeast Asia?
Yeah, well, Joe describes this as the jewel in the crown. To be frank, it's half the jewel in the crown because the Indonesia program, when I finished managing it about a decade ago, I think was worth close to 600, in fact, more than 600 million. And I think now it's down to about 300 million. And, you know, we've talked before about financial allocations, and my view is the government decides how much it wants to allocate. But let's not forget that there are more poor people living in Indonesia than there are people living in the Pacific. These are huge countries by and large by comparison to the Pacific. And in order to be relevant, there is a minimum stake. And while we probably are there for Indonesia, we need to be careful not to become irrelevant financially. So that's my first point. My second point would be, I don't think DFAT is in any risk of only looking at the world's development challenges through the Pacific lens. I don't think that's a problem. In some ways, I wish it was a problem because it would imply that we've got a fully developed Pacific lens, which I think we're still working on. I think, however, the obvious difference is that in the Pacific, the aid dollar is a significant proportion of the total GDP. And therefore, in many places, and possibly in all places, what Australia decides to do with this aid program has a strong outcome on what's happening in the country. In Southeast Asia, that's not the case anywhere except perhaps Laos. And I don't even know if that's true there. So we've got to get much better at thinking about how do you influence outcomes with tiny amounts rather than how you influence outcomes with comparatively large amounts. And I think that does change the game. And I think it does force you to look much more in the space that Diaz talked about, which is about leverage. It's about what is it that makes Australia a country worth being partners with. It's not going to be our total amount of money. Could it be the way we look at sort of problem solving? Could it be the way that we've helped crack some key, you know, social policy issues? Could it be, you know, the nature of the partnerships that we can create, government-to-government partnerships? But I do think it requires us to think differently. Obviously, the Office of Southeast Asia is a start. I'd note that it's not identical to the Office of the Pacific. The Office of Southeast Asia sits with one of the deputy secretaries who retains multiple other roles, I think possibly even including Ukraine. So whereas the recently announced new Pacific envoy, Ewan McDonald, is only, I think I'm right in saying, is only head of the Office of the Pacific. So even there, you can see that the allocations are slightly different. So I think this concept of partner of choice, which in the Pacific, we can achieve almost by dint of our geography and to some extent our culture, I'm not sure we can achieve in Southeast Asia through the same. Rugby league diplomacy ain't going to cut the mustard in the Philippines, for example. So we're going to have to work harder and be better.
Yeah, I wish our listeners could see Jo's face as she had a good cackle at your rugby reference there, James. I mean, I think you're right. I think what really excites me around what you're saying, James, is with that perhaps scarcity of resources and with that hunger that Australia is going to have to remain relevant and be, frankly, really useful and potentially catalytic in with a small amount of money in Southeast Asia, hopefully that brings with it some really tough choices to be weighed up as Australia implements a new development policy. Here at the lab, we try not to pick favourites amongst our Intel authors, but I am a little bit intrigued from both of you when it comes to this one. I mean, we have three beautifully different results. We've got Nicola Nixon from the Asia Foundation saying, really for Australia to be stepping up as a partner of choice in Southeast Asia, we need to invest in our relationships and to not overlook civil society relationships in particular. We've got Alex Dayant from MOE's Indo-Pacific Development Center saying, hey, his big play would be looking for more innovative financing mechanisms. And then, of course, we've covered Diaz, who's really calling on Australia to think long and hard about how we do our work. If you guys were heading up the Office of Southeast Asia, what would you be telling your staff to focus on, do you think?
I'm not sure I'm going to fall into your trap, Bridie, of choosing favourites, but I mean, of course, all three are correct. And I liked what they had to say on all fronts. But I guess, you know, just building on what James is saying, the nature of our status in the region, including as a donor, is very different. We do have to work harder at identifying and understanding our unique contribution, our comparative advantage, and convincing others of that in a much more crowded space. So I almost feel like we have a lot to learn from New Zealand, who always managed to do that. They managed to be the niche contributor, focus on something and do it really well. So I think, while I don't want to pick favourites, I do think that really reflecting on what Diaz is saying there about how you are a strategic learning partner and you find that niche and you do something really well would take us far.
What about you, James? What would you be encouraging your staff to do?
You know what I'd be encouraging them to do? I'd be encouraging them to learn an Asian language because I think that's another difference between us and the Pacific, right? The Pacific largely speaks English, don't they? They all speak English. That's not the case in Southeast Asia. So good luck developing relationships without being able to speak local languages.
Well, it's timely because as we're recording this, I think Widodo has just touched down and I understand that there will actually be an announcement around a pilot Indonesian learning program. So perhaps people out there are listening, James. All righty. Well, we are going to turn now to our third story for the day. Of course, we've been covering this for the last four episodes. This is no different. We are talking about Australia's new development policy. To be clear to everyone, it has not yet launched at the time of recording. But what we want to look at today in particular is something close to both of your hearts, Joe and Jane, and that is how the heck is Australia's new development policy going to seriously shift the needle on locally led development? You've both been major advocates in your organisations currently, as well as Jane's formerly at the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. So the question I have for you today is, what can Australia learn from USAID when it comes to locally led development? As a quick recap, USAID, of course, set out two major targets in 2021. They were considered fairly ambitious when they put them out there, of course, led by Samantha Power, the USAID administrator. Now, the first target, she said, was that by the end of 2025, that's just in 2 years' time, USAID was going to provide at least 25% of its program funds directly to local partners. And by 2030, half of USAID programming would take place in local communities, putting local communities in the driver's seat. James, do you remember when this announcement came out? How was it received?
What this is about is leadership, right? You can't be under any illusions about where Samantha Power wants to take this. So all power to her, and political leadership is perhaps the most important driver here. I think we've seen across the board challenges in implementing that, and she will have exactly the same challenges. I think I mentioned the Grand Bargain earlier. Grand Bargain has a very ambitious localization ambition as well, set in 2016. It hasn't been met. And in fact, when ODI did a review of the Grand Bargain, it pointed out that a lot of the highfalutin ambitions around localization weren't met. So I think fantastic that this agenda has been set. Great that not only has it been set, that they're monitoring it. That's an adequate development. But there are so many challenges in this, which I'm happy to talk about later. But there are so many challenges.
Well, of course, last month, USAID did release its first review on progress against these targets, and it's a bit of a mixed bag. The report tells us that they have reached a target of around about 10.2% of funding to local partners. So they're not quite halfway there with 2 years to go. But according to the report, this is the highest level and percent of direct local funding in at least a decade for USAID. Now, I recall when these targets were launched, I think they were broadly welcomed. There were a few cynical policymakers in Canberra saying, well, let's sit back and see how this goes. Joe, I'm worried these cynical policymakers might also be thinking, well, if USAID can't do it, nor can we. What's your take on this report and its results so far?
Well, I guess I agree with James that USAID is definitely leading in this space. And I think Samantha Power and the way that she has spoken about locally led development and localization is truly inspiring. Amongst all of the donor organizations, she has led the way and been the clearest and strongest advocate on this. So definitely hats off to them for that. Having said that, I do think that this first target about direct funding is quite a blunt instrument. I think the report's quite honest about some of the challenges in achieving it. And I guess it goes back to whether we're talking about locally led development versus localization, and what are the actual outcomes we're trying to achieve. I think you can have funding going to local organizations without necessarily meaning that those organizations are in the driver's seat for how that funding is used. And it can have kind of negative consequences if those organizations are then tying themselves up in knots trying to meet USAID requirements and so on. So I think there are risks around all of this, but it does seem from that report that they've thought about a lot of those risks. They're being quite honest about them. What I do like is that they've recognized that in order to achieve this, they need to change some things themselves. I think that's really important. And that probably is the part that needs a lot more emphasis. So, for instance, if they're going to have all of this funding go to local organizations, USAID have recognized they need more staff. And they also need to retain their local staff and have better incentives for their local staff to remain with them. So they're both things that they have put into action. They've created 130 new positions in the last 2 years just to enable this to happen. That's a real positive in the sense that, you know, more USAID staff engaging more directly with local organisations is a plus, is a positive. But hopefully it's also led to some changes and reflections on how that funding is administered in ways that do enable local organisations to really be in the driver's seat.
I was in DC last year and was lucky enough to catch Samantha Power speak three times. And the feeling and the integrity and the commitment was palpable when it came to overcoming some of the practical challenges that I think she knows full well her agency would face in greeting these targets. But James, you alluded to this earlier. Talk us through a couple of the challenges of implementing this kind of locally led agenda, and perhaps what would you want to see in a new Australian development policy when it comes to locally led development?
Well, I think Joe's spot on that the sort of narrative around why localization has been problematic has flipped from lack of capacity in partner countries. That doesn't cut the mustard anymore. I think Joe's right that this has to be about how we build and develop our own systems. Joe and I both know this closely because we have, when we bid for projects, we have to pay huge attention to risk and fraud money frameworks, which have an extremely detailed and complex expectation from DFAT as our client, and which is completely their prerogative. But it does create challenges around the degree to which local organizations can reflect some of those capacities or some of those policies. It's good that USAID has made available more staff, and I think that's something that DFAT will also need to get its head around, that this is actually going to be a more labor-intensive task. I think Samantha Power has also set targets for the amount of time and admin that some of these processes take up. So there is a recognition that this is about DFAT changing as well. And I love Joe's point about locally engaged staff. That is the great resource which DFAT has not tapped enough yet. So I think the focus does swing back to DFAT and its processes. It needs to have targets. I think those targets are a good idea. It needs to have leadership, but it needs to also have practical changes in the way that the aid program is administered that will allow the less well-resourced local groups to take the sort of role that people like Samantha Power envisage.
Well, I think that is a good note to finish on, James and Joe. Thank you for another great episode of The Readout. And hopefully when we're back here in a fortnight's time, we are talking about the much anticipated release of the development policy. If not, we'll come up with something just as good to chat about then.
Hope springs eternal, eh, Bridie?
Always, James, tempered by those wise and more wily than myself. All righty then, we'll catch you all soon.
Thank you. See you next time. Bye.
The Readout is recorded on the lands of the Ngunnawal and Ngambri peoples, the traditional custodians of the Canberra area. We pay our respects to the elders, past, present, and emerging. This series, we've got two regular guests appearing on the program, Joe Cho and James Gilling. Joe is Head of Program Quality and Gender at DT Asia Pacific, and James is Regional Vice President East Asia and Pacific at ABT Associates. Both are appearing on The Readout in their personal capacity. The Readout will be back in 2 weeks' time. Subscribe to The Readout wherever you listen to your podcasts and sign up for the lab emails via our website. Content production by Julie Bolton. Music by Vijani Matile.